Folklorist Henry Glassy, who has written extensively about the Irish community of Ballymanone, whose conflicts and history, he says, are a microcosm of Ireland's. Glassy says he wanted to write accurately and usefully about the workaday reality of other people. He writes, quote, "I wanted to know how people who share my world make it despite boredom and terror. Northern Ireland was a good choice," unquote. Ballymanone is in Northern Ireland. It's a small rural community about 8 miles from the border of the Republic of Ireland. Glassy's study, which was begun in 1972, is the subject of his new book called Passing the Time in Ballymanone. And this book includes the stories told by the community historians, other stories passed on through generations and songs, as well as his descriptions and analysis of day-to-day life in the community. Selected transcriptions of stories and songs are also published in a companion volume called Irish Folk History, Tales from the North. Both books are published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Glassy is a professor of folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. Henry Glassy, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here again.
Can you tell us why you decided to do this study and to set it in Ballymanone?
Well, why I set it in Ballymanone is probably only an accident of an individual searching across a landscape and finding a place that pleased him. Why I did the study, though, I think is very easy to state. I'm a folklorist, and folklorists are people whose job it is to celebrate the kinds of values in communities that are different from our own. Basically, folklore is a critical science which searches through the world to discover people whose ways of life are very different from ours. But what I've discovered in many years as a folklorist is that when I celebrate these people, when I attempt to understand them and present their views on the page or attempt to understand their arts, normally people tell me, ah, yes, but they occupy some very distant, misty realm in the past. They really don't have anything to do with our reality. So what I wanted to do, I mean, this was as much a guidance as I had, what I wanted to do was to do folkloristic kind of work to study people whose orientations were to tradition, whose orientations were to community, whose vision was more sacred than secular, who worked directly with the dirt, all of these kinds of things that one would normally think of when one thinks of a folklorist and his work. But at the same time, I wanted those people to be set dramatically in the modern world. I didn't want people to be able to dismiss the writings that I did about such people by saying, ah, yes, but they have an easier time. They really didn't have any choice but to be in a nice, neat, trim little community. I didn't want to be, for the kinds of human beings that I have learned to honor, to be dismissed as a mere romantic sort of figment. And so what I did was to go to the north of Ireland, where the modern world presses enormously upon the lives of every human being, and in the north of Ireland to find a community split between Catholics and Protestants so that no one could say they were a community merely because they had no, it never crossed their minds to be anything other than a community. I wanted to be in a community where people had, in fact, every excuse to blow up, every excuse to hate their neighbor, every excuse to reject the tradition, every excuse to break away into materialistic as opposed to spiritual values. And yet what I found was that though they occupied a tremendously modern and tremendously dangerous situation, they still had the courage and capacity to maintain powerful connections to their land, to their community, to their history.
Can you set us geographically and politically in Ballymanone?
Very easily. Ballymanone is the community's own name for itself. It's not a name written on any map or to be found in any book. I didn't make it up. It's an absolutely real name. It simply means place of the river's mouth. And so that it's at the mouth of a little river called Arny that flows into Lough Erne in County Fermanagh in the north of Ireland. Where County Fermanagh is as far southwest as you could go and still be in Northern Ireland. It's also sort of curiously located because being in the southwestern corner of Northern Ireland, the community that I studied is north of the border that separates the Republic of Ireland from Northern Ireland, but it's also west of the border, and it's also east of the border, and curiously enough, because of the strange shape of the border in Ireland, it's also south of the border. So it's a thing that could only happen in Ireland. It's a place in the north that's totally surrounded on all sides by the south. Only Ireland could have a world in which the south wasn't directed in one direction from the north, but the south totally surrounds Northern Ireland in this corner.
And politically? Yeah.
Politically, County Fermanagh is the county that elected as Member of Parliament Bobby Sands, the first of the hunger strikers. Politically, County Fermanagh is interesting in that it has a Catholic majority, although in the days when the border was drawn through Ireland, the idea was that all those counties that had Protestant majorities would be ceded to the north and the counties with Catholic majorities would be ceded to the south. That's in fact not true. County Fermanagh has in its southern section a Catholic majority, so that I was in a place that was within the north of Ireland, in Ulster, but it was a place in which, in fact, the Catholic population was a majority. So there was a local majority that was in a national, that represented a national minority. And this local majority was, of course, tremendously active politically. But that doesn't mean that the kinds of newsreels that you see from Belfast properly represent the life in Ballymenone. Every street is bound with barbed wire. Down the little country lanes scream armored cars and tanks. The air is full of helicopters, and you constantly hear, and I mean quite constantly, perhaps every other night a bomb goes off in some little town. But this constant material reminders of a situation of war, a situation of war within which people basically carry on their farming life, doesn't mean in this area many deaths. There's a war being conducted by the Irish Republican Army upon British-held property, which means a lot of it gets blown up. There's an attempt by the English Army to defend this property against the IRA, therefore there's a lot of military presence. But it doesn't necessarily lead or hasn't led to a large number of deaths of human beings.
So do the people not think of themselves as living in the middle of a war?
They think of themselves, yes, as living in the middle of a war, but they really think of themselves as living in the middle of a trouble, and that will be the word that they use. They live in the troubles, and then if you ask them when did the troubles begin, did they begin in 1972 perhaps or 1968, the normal response is that no, the troubles began with perhaps the English invasion in the 12th century. More likely, they would say that the troubles began in the early 17th century with the settlement of the north of Ireland by Scottish and English settlers. And so that most people see themselves as existing in what amounts to a constant state of trouble. And although it happens to be at a high pitch now, and it was a low pitch between the wars, it was at a high pitch in the 1870s, it was low in the middle of the 19th century, but it was high in the late 18th, and then it was low, and it was high in the middle of the 17th. So they see themselves as living in a time that has waves that break like the waves of an ocean, and it just so happens they're now on a rising wave. They believe fully that that wave will settle down, but it'll never stop. And this is not a hopeful position, and nor is it necessarily the one that I would hope to have, and yet it's the position of the people there, so that they're used to military presence, but they will say of their parents that they too were used to military parents and their presence, and their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents. And to be Irish, they say, is to resist.
I'm not sure that if you asked people in most other countries about the origins of a struggle or a battle that they were in the middle of, that they'd trace it back to a few centuries ago or many centuries ago and be able to fill in that history. Is there a strong sense of the history in that area of Ireland? And if so, how's it passed on?
A tremendously strong sense of the history. It's partially an explanation. There's a need for explanation of the predicament that you inhabit. It's also true that unlike our schools, their schools don't teach these topics, and one of the reasons for the existence of a very strong and fertile traditional history is because Irish history is not a normal subject in the schools. And for many years, it was quite illegal to teach Irish history, so that there needed to be a professional set of historians who would preserve an explanation of the current predicament for human beings who were in it, because that explanation wasn't being provided in the schools. It might be that we who hear so much about wars in our schools would turn away from a history of wars in our conversations. But if you were in the middle of a war and had never been taught about that war in your schools or never had it adequately explained to you, then you might turn quickly and with excitement to the old men who can tell the history. That history, though, is you asked how it was passed on, and for the most part, it's been a very professional activity. That is, I'm not the kinds of history that I heard in Ballymenone. It's not a matter of a farmer who knows a legend about a field. There's certainly lots of farmers who knew lots of legends about fields. But there really were people called historians. They would be called Shanachies in Irish. The people that I knew didn't speak Irish, and they didn't use the word Shanachie. They used the word historian. But the historian was truly a professional, not in the sense of being paid, but in the sense of being a specialist. And the historians that I knew, Michael Boyle and Hugh Nolan, who were the great historians of the community of Ballymanone, had in fact been taught quite formally by Richard Corrigan and Hugh McGeveney, who were old men and when they were young men, and those old men had in turn been taught by old men, so that the kind of history that people know about the great events that engulf them is a history that they don't themselves, it seems paradoxical, that they don't themselves necessarily know. They just know the man who knows the history. And if they have a problem, they go to that man. But there are really two kinds of purveyors of history, which creates part of the complexity of the mood of Irish history and the mood, therefore, of human action within it. There's one kind of history that's presented normally in public. And if you're Protestant, that history usually is a matter of parades, great, thundery, happy, crazy parades full of drum beating and wearing of uniforms, and they really are great events. And if you're Catholic, that history normally comes in terms of ballads. You go into a public house. They usually don't call them pubs, but public houses. You go into a public house and someone sings a stirring rendition of some ballad of a martyr in 1920 who gave his life for dear old Ireland. And so there's a public kind of presentation which is always stirring, always very pointed and rhetorical and exciting. But then there are the professional historians, and their job is to sit at home and say, ah, yes, it's true that that man was a great hero, but really he wasn't that great. And it's true that that was a great victory, but really and truly, if you examine the situation more closely, the Irish, instead of beating the English, in fact, in that war that you've just heard this great stirring song about, in fact, in that war, the Irish really beat an army led by the English but composed of Irishmen, and in fact it was just the same kind of war that we're involved in today. Ironic, confused, Irishmen fighting Irish, and the great proverb is, the Irish is bad to the Irish. And so that you as a person attempting to, let's say you're a young person in the north of Ireland today and you want to locate yourself in time, you would have a little bit of history from your schools, but that would be largely British history or a very official version of Irish history. Then you would go into the streets, and in the streets and in the bars, you would hear this stirring, strident, nationalistic or anti-nationalistic history if you were Protestant or Catholic. Then you would go home, and there you would sit quietly at a small fire, just a little glow, and you'd listen to old Hugh Nolan, who would tell you that everything that you'd been told in the streets was not quite true. It was not all that clear. In fact, things are much more ironic. There are many more paradoxes, many more dilemmas. And that, in fact, if you look at the past, it's basically a situation of people fighting and constantly losing, and when they win, they lose worse, and the situation is always miserable. And therefore, the conclusion is, you've got to carry on. And that's what they say, you've got to carry on.
Are most of the people that are conscious of those three levels of history, the official history, the street history, and the historian history?
The historians are fully aware of them. I believe that they probably, most people don't make those kinds of distinctions. That's me presenting a somewhat clear, I'm a professional ethnographer, I'm a folklorist. So I present the image a little bit more clearly than people probably have it already preset in their mind. But I've been interested that even in the county about which I wrote, Fermanagh, that the newspaper reviews, both Protestant and Catholic, have been very positive about my work, and so that I've gotten a kind of feedback, in a sense, from the people there that the patterns that I'm seeing are patterns that they believe to be true, and they'll say, well, we never quite thought of it that way, but upon introspection, that seems to be about the way it is. I think for most people, what it is closer to being a dilemma. They hear all these things and don't really sort them out into levels. They just hear this strident, stirring nationalistic history, then they hear this ironic, confused, dilemma-ridden history, and they just exist in the middle, in fact, acting paradoxically themselves, acting inconsistently. And one of the things that anyone would have to know right out of the newspapers of the north of Ireland is a tremendous inconsistency in action, how people will say that what we must have is an Irish nation, and then they'll say, but we must have an Irish nation in which all can feel comfortable. And so there's a pattern of inconsistency which seems to me to be allowed to exist because people basically are there trained into a kindness, trained into a security concerning the way the social world is, that really and truly out in the countryside, Protestants don't distrust Catholics, and Catholics are not mad at Protestants, and they're really not angry at each other, and they're secure enough that their neighbors at least are their friends, and that their neighbors at least will help them if they get in trouble. And the big troubles are really agricultural more than political, that since their neighbors are going to help them, then they are somehow allowed inconsistent actions in public. They're allowed by their neighbors of the opposite side to make violent pronouncements in the street because their neighbors know they don't really believe that.
Since the historians speak of the paradox and the confusion of history, are they political? Do they take sides?
They're always political, and they've always taken sides, and that might seem wrong, but it's not. The historians are always of one side, purely of one side. But by being of one side, you see, it's the same kind of seemingly paradoxical structure. By being clearly, as Hugh Nolan was, not only a Catholic, but a fervent nationalist, then he's allowed, he has the right to criticize his own side. If he were waffling, and if his political position were insecure, and then he were critical of the Catholic nationalist position, people wouldn't believe him. But by being a firm, strong man who was a IRA man in his youth and who braved, you know, risked his body for his nation, then as he's in his 80s, all the historians are elderly. It's a role for old people. Then people are willing to give him a lot of credit and to listen to him. And when he softens up their attitudes and when he argues with the rhetoric of the street, people are perfectly willing to give him credence because his position is secure. And he's perfectly willing to explore critical alternatives because his position is secure. I think a lot of times historians, that is professional historians in our world, think that if you have a secure political position, you therefore can't do history. I honestly believe with, let's say, the great historian Christopher Hill, that the opposite is the case, that if you have a very clear political position, then everybody knows, as they say in the argo, where you're coming from, and you are so secure in your position that you're allowed to explore alternative possibilities and to be critical of your own side and to see its failings as well as its successes.
Would you be able to summarize for us what he would say about why he was in the IRA and why his position is what it is?
Well, I think the old men who served might be often ashamed of what they did because there's a great tendency for the old men who are the historians, and they are male. It's a male role. There's powerfully significant female roles, but being a historian isn't one of them. The old men are very often ashamed of what they did because as they grow older, they tend to grow more religious. They tend to develop out of their religious beliefs a universal opinion of mankind and believe that the universal man is more important than the particular political position. So very often the elderly person is ironic not only because he knows more about history and sees more of its facets, but also ironic because he basically thinks life is more important than politics. And so the rationale of one of the elderly historians about his role as a nationalistic fighter would be perhaps not, wouldn't help us much understand this current situation. The young men who I talked to who were politically committed and who I think are courageous, without saying that I agree with them, that doesn't mean that I can't believe in the courage of a soul. I mean, I find it astounding and that a person could starve themselves to death. It seems, and part of me says that's benighted and preposterous, and another part of me says that's an amazing, noble, courageous, heroic act. But I talk to certainly very active young men. They tend to have a most profoundly to be romantic nationalists. after the fashion of Herder in the 19th century, after the fashion of, the whole kind of romantic movement that really grew out of Rousseau's critique. And they tend to be romantic nationalists. I'm not certain that that's the way they would want it said of them, but they really do believe in the nation. They believe in the nation's spirit. They believe that a broken Ireland is as analogous to rending a body, that there is a body fabric to Ireland and that it must be unified. They believe that fabric is diverse, though, and so that I talked to one of the young men who, as they say, plays in the game, and he said that one of the reasons that he was willing to die was so that the Orange Lodges could continue to parade, was so that the Protestants would continue to have their traditions, but so that those traditions would be recognized for what they were, which is an Irish tradition as opposed to an English tradition. That he wanted, he didn't have an excluding kind of consciousness. He wanted to include, to draw the Protestants back into being Irish. And I would say that most of all the Protestant country people that I knew, they called themselves Irish, thought of themselves as Irish. After all, their ancestors came from England to Ireland at the very beginning of the 17th century. They've been there as long as people of European blood have been in eastern United States. And so they feel a tremendous Irish identity and feel tremendously a part of that country, and they don't think of themselves at all as English. The upper class Protestants of the north of Ireland often think of themselves as British, and we call themselves British, and even usually with, I think, comically, to develop English accents. But the people that I knew, country people, some of them prosperous, some of them not so prosperous, who were Protestant, had the same Fermanagh accent that their Catholic neighbors did. They lived in the same kinds of houses. They farmed in the same way. They had the same values, the same attitudes. I think finally and profoundly, they had the same religion. They had a different name for it. But if you ask them sort of outside of the church building, what do they believe? There's no difference in fundamental belief between Protestants and Catholics. They all believe that God created the world and he commanded us to love, and that we are tragically breaking the sacred commandment by our continuing fight and wish it were over.
So in that community, what does the fighting boil down to?
In that community, I'd say there is none. I mean, without just being elaborate, that community sees itself as holding tensely and with great difficulty, as holding itself together against all the forces of division that flow in from the outside. Now, this isn't exactly true, but it's the way they like to think of it, and it's the way they present it. It's their ideal. They think of themselves as my neighbors, though Protestants are not my enemies. And very frequently it is true. I found that Protestants and Catholic men who live next door to each other did work together in the fields and did lend each other tools and did go drinking with each other and were great friends. One of the ways that they can maintain that friendship is both of them recognizing that the other one, when in the street, has to act Protestant or Catholic. And they know those rules, and so they know that when that person then comes home to the community, he can still be a good neighbor even though in the street, so that my neighbor can march at the head of the black preceptory on August 12th, and yet when he comes home, I can have a drink with him in his kitchen.
You've said that Irish culture does not favor resolution. Would you explain what you mean by that?
Well, in this context, what I discovered was when I paid attention to, let's say, the art forms that these people most appreciate, I didn't find the same obsession with conclusions. You can think of your freshman English class, and you're asked how to write a paper, and you say, well, it must have a beginning and a middle and an end. I found these people very uninterested in beginnings and ends and tremendously interested in middles, and that very much of their culture is organized around a theory of centeredness, a theory of middles and centers, and where beginnings are and where ends are don't interest them very much. We've talked about history. They're tremendously interested in the flux and movement of history, but the beginning of history isn't of great concern to them, and honestly, where we're going isn't of great concern. They're much more interested in a kind of philosophy that we might think of as slightly oriental, their vision is much more getting in relationship to what's happening now, balancing with it, using the past as an aid to achieving balance, but not so that the past can overwhelm you, but just so that you won't be overwhelmed by it. The question of resolution then shows up in the way to me, in the way that they organize homes, in the way that they organize the platters within the homes, in the way they tell stories, in the way they work in the fields, in the way that they have a very unritualized existence. Their life cycle isn't very ritualized. When people come into the house, you don't knock on the door, you don't stop in the threshold, there's no beginning, you simply walk in and sit down. And what you do is join in a conversation that's already going, and then when you want to leave, you get up and go. There are very few greeting formulas. People don't stop much. Things are kind of flowing along. Well, what this, to my mind, has to do with the political situation is that these are people quite accustomed to existing in a world in which beginnings and ends are not clear, and middles are the great excitement. They're very interested in establishing conflicts and describing conflicts and not necessarily searching for their resolutions. And I think this is one of the great problems in the past 12 years in Northern Ireland, is that an English government, and I'm not that I think has the best interests in the world, at least initially, the best interests in the world of the Irish people, really wanted to do right. But the difference was that the English government's principles were founded on a theory of resolution. What was peace? Well, peace was the utter absence of conflict. Whereas the Irish tradition of peace is that peace is an activity that entails a great deal of conflict, but the conflict doesn't come to dominate. And so that if you come into a world where people have always thrown the occasional rock through a window or have always boycotted pubs, have always marched for their rights, I mean, it's a tremendous tradition of public display of the kinds that were quite common in America in the 60s and really weren't that common before and weren't that common after. We think of that as a period of public demonstrations. But Ireland has always had public demonstrations. There's always been a tolerable level of unrest. And that tolerable level of unrest is something that I find in their stories, and I find in the way that people organize their evenings. I find in the way that people organize their meals, which have very casual beginnings, very casual endings, that people don't really mind things and trailing off. They have a whole sets of genres of folk tales that are just allowed to trail off. There's no once upon a time, there's no they live happily ever after in their stories. The stories kind of begin in conversations, and in the middle you know you've got a story because it's rich and exciting and poetic, and then all of a sudden it kind of trails off into the conversation. Where it began and ended is sort of confusing. And their historical political senses like that. We're now at a high point of political activity. It'll go down, but it really won't go away. And that formed an attitude that seems to me to have come into perfect conflict with the English government's attitude, which was that conflicts have beginnings, they have ends, they have causes, there's a way to stop them. We can have a political solution, and the political solution will end the conflict. Whereas the people there are so accustomed to conflict, I'm not saying that they're insane and they want it, but they can tolerate it. They can get along with their neighbors despite it. They can get through another day. They can go to the store and do their shopping. The kids can be raised without going bananas if there's a little bit of conflict.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Henry Glassie, who's a professor of folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. And since 1972, he's been working on a study of the community of Ballymenone in Northern Ireland. And two books have just been published based on that work that he's doing. One is called Passing the Time in Ballymenone, and that's the larger text that includes his study of the daily life there and many of the stories and histories and songs that have been passed on. And then the smaller book is selections from those stories and histories and songs. And the smaller book is called Irish Folk History, Texts from the North. They're both published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Well, since we're in a chapter now talking about what this all means politically, how do you read the newspapers now? When As you've explained, you're seeing what's happening in Ireland from a very different perspective than a news reporter is, who's looking at events as opposed to the kind of underlying culture of the people. What do you look for when you read it, and how do you read between the lines?
It's interesting that you mention events, because I think that's probably my orientation not only to the current political situation but as well to history. There's a kind of double harmony here, that the historian looks at the past for great events as the journalist looks at the present for great events. And I, as a folklorist, look at the past for its continuities and its patterns and perhaps for its very minor occurrences, just as I look at the present for the texture of life as opposed to the great events. What I see is, when I read the newspapers, I see at one level exactly what anybody else would see. I see the report of another death. Knowing the countryside, knowing the, let's say, having been stopped very frequently by young British soldiers, I have a pity for them that's deeper, so that one, obviously from simply having been there, there's more passion in my reading. But I'm afraid that the biggest change that's occurred to me, and that the newspapers only reinforce, is that when I went to Northern Ireland, I went with a very American kind of consciousness. And that American consciousness is quite like the English consciousness, which I believe has consistently misunderstood the Irish situation. And that's a consciousness that believes that problems have solutions. And so that I went to Northern Ireland really out of personal experience in civil rights, and realizing that the Irish civil rights movement was even patterned to a great degree on the black movement of the 60s, and having been part of that and honored it, I could say, well, there's going to be a kind of similarity. But all I've really done is to learn how confusing it is. And the more I know, the less I know. The more I understand about it, the more, in fact, compassion I have for all sides. It seems to me that people are truly earnestly searching for things. They're simply, that is, for solutions in Northern Ireland, but speaking the wrong language. They don't speak a language that the other person understands. The conflicts are never direct. They're always, the sort of opposed forces always come into combat obliquely in such a way that they bounce off each other instead of either coming to a real violent or peaceful conclusion. And that basically I begin to, I suppose at one level, achieve the kind of disgust and boredom which might be something like the disgust and boredom in Northern Ireland. There doesn't seem to me to be any reason to have another TV show of kids throwing rocks at tanks in Belfast. I think that's just exploitative. Those kids are not the better or the worse from it. We don't learn any more or less about the situation. The report of another English soldier dead disgusts me, saddens me. The report of another election confused by violence depresses me. I suppose my reaction is that I've lost the ability to think that the thing has a solution. Honestly, that what I've done is to be there now for 10 years and to have thought so much about the situation that I see virtue and vice, I see good and bad in every position that anyone could announce concerning the north of Ireland. And so that I find that the best thing for me is honestly non-involvement. The kinds of political discussions that you and I have had have been a matter of kind of ruminations on my cultural study. And it doesn't seem to me that I'm faking anything by doing that kind of ruminating. That basically I've understood the folk tales, and I've understood the way people organize the farm year, and I've worked and I've brought the hay in and I've cut turf and I've worked in the bog. I know what that life is like. And by simply having felt that texture, there's certain maybe flickers of understanding I have concerning the political situation, but I don't understand it. And so that when I read the things in the newspaper from the north of Ireland, I basically think of them very much like the things that I read in the newspaper about the United States. They aren't the right facts, and so they're just news. And I've learned that the news from Northern Ireland, like the news from the United States, has nothing to do with what's happening. It's just what newspapers fill themselves up with.
As a folklorist, I think you really are developing your own approach to trying to understand the culture that you're looking at. Would you be able to explain to us how you do it, what that approach has evolved into?
The approach is nothing more than scientifically being compassionate, to try to come to try to imagine being someone else. Let's say in the case of Ballymenone, to try to imagine being religious. It's not natural to me by any means, but I found it very exhilarating and wonderfully, deeply challenging to try to imagine thinking of the world, of a world that was genuinely immanent with the sacred. And I found that a tremendously moving experience. Not that I am religious, but that I would try to, in a sense, try on the religious consciousness for a while. I found it an extremely impressive worldview. It's certainly terrifically reorganized my own thinking to try to do that. That is to try to imagine thinking of the world of a world that really does vibrate and pulse with the presence of a deity. I can no longer dishonor that position as irrational. And I think I was really trained by my parents, by my schooling, by my civilization, to think of progress as being fundamentally the elimination of that impulse. There are no such things as ghosts, you know, trees don't have souls, that if you think in that way, you're thinking pre-rationally, non-logically. By trying that kind of consciousness on for a while, what I found was that that was a wonderfully enlightening way to view certain problems in the world. That isn't quite the answer to your question, which was more about method. How in the world would I come to this attempt to imagine being another, which is what it really is all about? I don't think that observing behavior gets you very far. It's one of the modes. That is, if you sort of think about what you think social scientists do. What I've really found more useful is to try to pay attention to the texts that the people themselves create, because then I'm not merely watching a flicker of behavior, let's say. I'm really having to come to grips with a big, thick product totally made by them. I don't know how that product is invested with their spirit. I don't know how that product contains their consciousness, but I'm convinced that it does. And so that if I spend the time that I did, let us say, making measured drawings of every single house in Ballymenone, that on the one hand looks like kind of idiot work, but on the other hand, what I've had to do is to imagine being the designer of every one of those houses. And the more I imagine being the designer, the more I begin to be able to understand the values that were the basis for the design of the houses. I got to make a house. What's the house supposed to do? And I found the houses of Ballymenone were designed to get people as quickly as possible into social engagement. There are no hallways, no lobbies. There's no symmetrical facades that would prevent you from knowing what lies on the other side. Instead, the guiding design principle of those houses was sociability. I couldn't just know that by walking in. I might sense that, but I could never demonstrate it to myself, and I'm my own best critic, and so that I want a scientific kind of demonstration that my attempt to be compassionate is not sentimental or goofy or off the beam. And so I measured all the houses, and so I recorded every single story that was told in Ballymenone. I didn't just record the stories that tickled me. Whatever they thought was significant enough to form into a narrative, then I thought that was significant enough for me to pay attention to it. And the simple act of transcribing every one of those stories from tape, of having to feel through my hands every single word that was uttered, caused me to think about their structuring, caused me again to think about what are the values that are inherent in these stories. And so that's the place where what looks initially like a strident, stirring political statement, when you really have to deal with every one of its words, you begin to understand its ironies and how it's sort of folding back on itself, kind of like those beasts in the Book of Kells that gobble themselves up. The story is kind of eating itself up, sort of destroying its own metaphors and undercutting its own political force. And it's only by really listening very, very hard not to some, but to every story they tell, that I can begin to move toward a principled understanding of what their values are, and then I can begin to imagine, how would you act if you had those values? How would you act if you had their sense of what an individual is? How would you act if you had their sense of what history is and the way history entraps you? History is not a topic for school, but history is what I'm doing. I'm doing history. I'm creating history. If you had their sense of the sacred, that it wasn't just a transcendent moment on Sunday morning, but it was the way you dug in the dirt, and that it was the way you sang and the way you talked, and that every word has to somehow... this isn't me being fancy. These are just me listening very hard to my friends. Peter Flanagan said that. He said that all human acts are attempts at prayer. And so that my talking to you right now, if I were from Ballymanone, I would be having to think that this is a moment which would, I would, the best thing I could do with this would be praying. But you can't be praying all the time. So I have to orient our conversation as close as I can to a prayer, which is an honoring of our social relationships, which is the way they see it, an honoring of the commandment to love.
So is this why you used stories as really, I think, the basis of your study, because it is like the text of the people of that community? It is like the product?
That's right. Yeah, the big book really hits, use two major texts. One of them are stories, and I use them precisely because I wanted to deal with the world as they constructed it, not as I constructed it. I think I could observe them acting forever. I wanted to be able to record whole things that they'd made that I had to come to grips with. It's real hard to push them around. It's very hard to mull those texts. People say, oh, you're reading into it and so on. But if you've got 300 stories, it's pretty tough to read a fake message into 300 long stories that are full of meaning.
Has mass media affected the telling of the stories?
Tremendously. But it hasn't eliminated them. It's just meant a kind of reorganization. Funny enough, the little book, Irish Folk History, that you mentioned is a mass media product, in fact. The larger book, Passing the Time in Ballymanone, I wrote for me and you. I wrote Irish Folk History for them. That's the book they want. It has none of me. There's not a word of my analysis in it, none of this blathery folklore. It's nothing but their words. 100% of that book is their words, and that's what they want. And I wanted to give that back to them. But giving back to those people their words in book form wasn't an attack or upon the oral tradition or a destruction of it. It was, in fact, a fortunate shift in their lives from the very moment that they're shifting towards an orientation to the mass media, that they'll now have in book form the kinds of things that once were told. Because the old historians who made that book, Michael Boyle, Hugh Nolan, James Owens, are all dead. Ellen Cutler, dead. You see, so that I happened to hit those great historians at the very moment when they had these stories to tell, but they had no apprentices. For a millennium before that, the old men had always had young men who would come and sit at the hearth and learn the history. But for Hugh Nolan, who died in 1981, for Michael Boyle, who died in 1974, James E. Owens died just this year, 1982, all these men, none of them had apprentices. And so that also answers another question, you know, how did you as folklorist enter this community? I was dragged into it. It's just that simple. These were old men who knew they'd preserved this tremendously precious but tremendously fragile inheritance. They were desperate to have it taped. The idea that, I mean, I was just an angel. I came out of nowhere. I had this wonderful machine that would record their words. And now for the next generation is a totally different one. Electricity came to Ballymanone in 1976. When I first went there in 1972, there was no electricity. People were heating their houses by the hearth. Now people have got TVs, they've got cars. They are, as P. Flanagan says, becoming modern in the 11th hour. and becoming modern at with great speed. And so that this, the next generation, that is the farm, the people who own the farms of Ballymenone are now my age, and they're book readers, just as I am. And so it's just fortunate, by sheer accident, that that generation in this community was bridged by a book, whereas in most communities that generation has been bridged by silence, not bridged at all. Unfortunately, things like oral history die, but they're replaced by other things, and one of the things that they'll be replaced by is a written history more sensitive to the needs of the people.
Just the fact that you are an outsider and it was you to whom the history was passed on, of course you're giving it back, but you were someone from the outside.
Sure.
Does that mean that the younger generation wasn't much interested? I mean, does it go to their interests as well as to the existence of the media?
Oh, that's right. Sure. I don't think the media are the cause of the lack of interest. It's a whole tremendous package of things. It's true that the people, let's say my age, in the community of Ballymenone weren't interested. It's also true that 10 years have passed, and now the people who are still my age now are interested. And of course they are. And that's exactly what you'd expect. But the difference is that could there have been any way to bridge that gap? And I just happened, as an outsider, to be that person. It would be the hope of outsiders like me to train insiders. And that's certainly one of the things that we do in folklore is I think it's most exciting to get students from Africa and have them return to Africa to do their work instead of for me to go there and do it instead of them. But if there's no one within the community who's interested in doing this work, then better an outsider than no one. Because always it will happen that there will be a next generation that's going to want that history, want those stories.
We're about out of time, but there's something else I'd like to ask you. Earlier on the show this week, Nora Sierra was here, and she's a writer from New York who's she's really studying the 50s now, mm-hmm. and has already written a book about the films of the 50s, and now is writing more about the politics and culture, and she did also a book on the late 60s and early 70s. We were talking, and she said, I think one of the problems in this country is that the older generation neglects to pass on to the younger generations what it knows and what it's experienced. And I said, well, maybe the younger generation doesn't really want to hear it. And we really kicked that around for a while. But you're an American who went to another country and got some of that history passed on to you. What do you think about history amongst your contemporaries here and how it's handled? I mean, do you feel that the older generation should be passing it on more so than it is, or that the younger generation isn't much interested, or that history has... everybody says, people are apathetic about the past.
Well, I have like everything else, I've got too many thoughts about that. Sure, I think the older generation ought to be passing it on, but I don't blame them for not doing it. Sure, I think the younger generation should be accepting of that history, but I honestly don't blame them for not wanting any part of it. I think this is largely the fault of the profession of history, and not a fault of parents and not a fault of children. That is, if someone says, let's hear the stories about the old days are either corny and uninteresting, or they're always used to chide the youth that you don't really have it tough and I had it tough. It seems that the past is inevitably freighted. And the problem is whether it's freighted with something that would be interesting to the next generation. It so happens in Ballymenone that the past is freighted with, to a great degree, with violence. And this is still a relevant issue for someone who's trying to figure his or her life out in the world. But if you don't think of your life as having hardship and violence, to be told about hardship and violence may be of no use to you at all. I would think that what I really think is that the problem has been by the professional historian who has attempted to make history seem irrelevant or seem not salient. In a truly oral history, you see, there's absolutely no way you can have a boring history. It can't exist because all of history depends upon the qualities of memory and the qualities of telling. It's not merely history, it's also good story. And the kind of stories that Hugh Nolan told, which were heard by young people in the community as well as myself. It's not that he had no audience at all. It's just that he didn't have a kind of apprentice, and that audience, now having grown a little bit older, is really glad that that book is there. And I feel sure that 100 years from now, one will go back to Ballymenone, and there will be an oral history. It won't be as rich, but there will be an oral history. So long as that oral history continues to adjust itself to be culturally useful. And the problem has been that history has been, I think, in our world, either freighted with irrelevance. We had a hard time, and you slug-a-bed kids haven't had a hard time. Or freighted with an even more violent kind of irrelevance, which is a kind of pseudoscience, that we're not really interested in using history as a mode of exploring the present. We're interested in the past for its own sake. Well, that seems to me, I mean, maybe the word for that might be decadent. Who cares about the past for its own sake? The past doesn't care about itself. The reason to study history is to illuminate current problems. And if either the professional historian or the garrulous dad forgets that the reason to talk about the past is to help people through the present, then there's no reason for history. I'm not at all pessimistic about history. I have the belief that there are many very important, excellent historians of every age, that is, professional academic historians, who are attempting to recenter history in usefulness, who are trying to bring history back into having some value, because it obviously does. Without the past, we quote Jefferson, we're doomed to relive it. We're doomed to repeat our failures. But with a useless past, we're not going to be saved from messing up either. If the past doesn't help us, then we don't need it anyway. I think it's more the problem, honestly, of the attitudes that people have toward what history is. And if history is a bunch of dates of rich guys in the 18th century, who cares? But if history is the story of, let's say, the development of the ethnic populations of Philadelphia, you have no trouble getting people interested in that.
Yeah. Joe, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's really been interesting.
Thank you.
Henry Glassy has been with me, and he's a folklorist. He's a professor of folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. And we've been talking about a study that he's done over the past 10 years in a small community at the very south of Northern Ireland, right near the border. And that community is called Ballymenone. And there's two books I want to mention. They're companion volumes that he's written. The first is called Passing the Time in Ballymenone. And that's the text of his study. It's his analysis and his observations, as well as the stories and histories and songs of the people of Ballymenone. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and that's called Passing the Time in Ballymenone. The smaller text is called Irish Folk History, Texts from the North, and that's just selected transcriptions of the stories and the songs, and he said that that's really his attempt to pass back to the Irish community the stories that they passed on to him. That's also published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's 2 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and in just a couple of minutes we'll be joined by Patricia Elliott, who's starring in The Keeper, which is a Drama Guild production of a show about Lord Byron. She'll be with us in a few minutes. And in about an hour on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by the editor of Soldier of Fortune magazine. And in a half hour, Francis Davis will be here with this week's edition of Interval. This is Fresh Air. Francis Davis will